Welcome to the Carl Jackson Podcast. I am excited and delighted that you guys are watching us on CJC Television Network and on listening to us on the Spotify network. We are now available to listen to as well as watch. So you can watch these episodes on Spotify. Thank God for that. There's not many that are able to do that. So we're appreciative of that. We're also appreciative of iTunes, who post our podcast. And to the thousands, at least, millions can reach us, can watch us, but thousands that watch this show, this podcast. So I want to say thank you to all of you who watch us every week. Today, I have a special guest, and I say special guest a lot, but this one means it's, this one's connected to my heart. When I was a kid, growing up in Dallas, Texas, we were raised in kind of a religious home, so we could not listen to R&B music. We couldn't listen to, we couldn't watch secular movies. We couldn't do any of this stuff. So one of the things I would do at 7 or 8 years old is I could go through my mom's gospel record collection and look at the producers and listen to their work. And one of the things that I just kind of gravitated to was reading the credits. We don't read credits anymore because music is, you can get it anywhere now. You can go to your phone and pick a song. But during the time I was raised, you had records, you had cassettes, you had CDs, and you could actually read the liners. And I kept seeing this name, Bill Maxwell. And a lot of people knew him from, you know, Andre Crouch. That's an easy one. But what people didn't know was the stuff that I know, which is Bill Maxwell produced a lot of great artists, not just during that time, but even now. But during that time, it was a lot of great artists, from Keith Green to Bruce Hibbert. A lot of people don't know who Bruce Hibbert is, but I was raised on Bruce Hibbert's one record that he did. there's so many that I can't even, Barry McGuire, Cosmic Cowboy, Daryl Coley, live record, the one that everybody talks about with the song, I Can't Tell It All. I don't know the name of it, but he's done so much stuff outside of Andre that I was like, this is my dream interview. And I reached out to him for like months, probably a couple years. And it was radio silent. I heard that he was not one of those people that liked to do interviews. And so I was praying, I'm like, God, I really want to get Bill Maxwell because he inspires me so much. And just listening to some of the old records, I listen to a lot of old music. And for me, nothing compares to the sound that Bill was able to produce with all these great records. So I humbly request that you guys welcome with me, Mr. Iconic Bill Maxwell.
Well, that's too much of an introduction. Thank you, Carl.
How you doing, sir?
I'm doing good.
Great. Good.
Awesome. In Los Angeles.
Los Angeles?
Yep.
And I am in San Diego, so we're like right down the street from each other.
That's right.
And I wanted to say thank you because I know today is your wife's birthday, so happy birthday to her. And I know you guys are going to have some fun tonight, so we're going to try to make this as painless as possible. But I wanted to ask you, first of all, before I go into your whole ridiculous resume, how did you start in music, and why did you gravitate to playing drums?
I had always played since beginning of my memories. I played something. My mother was a piano player, and she died when I was 2 months old, and so my grandparents essentially raised me. My father died when I was 10, and they had me in a music preschool when I was 2. So I started playing. I learned how to read treble clef before I learned how to read words. And then I just started playing around with xylophones and drums and a keyboard and a clarinet and a violin and guitar. I always was trying something. I decided on piano, stuck with that till I was about 12. And I didn't like the rigor of playing the same thing the same way as a classical piano teacher. It just kind of got boring, and rock and roll drums seemed like rebellion and fun. And it came to me very quick. So started playing drums when I was 12 and started working 13 and at playing drums and started playing in nightclubs at 14.
So at 14, you were playing in nightclubs with bands?
Yes.
And you were in Oklahoma, right? Correct?
Oklahoma, yes, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
And so what type of bands would you play with at 14 in Oklahoma City? I'm curious.
Well, Oklahoma City was had a lot of variety in it, and you had to play what was popular, but a lot of things would maybe be popular in Oklahoma that weren't popular other places. So, you know, every band had to play a little bit of country. We played mostly R&B, James Brown songs, and Otis Redding songs, things of Stax, Motown. But then we would also, we had kind of a Jimmy Smith type of organ bass thing. We would do jazz clubs. So that was the start.
And so you did that from 14 to what age?
Well, I promised I would graduate.
Before you became professional, that's what I mean.
I worked all the way through high school, six nights a week.
Wow. So you were getting paid to do this?
Yeah, and I was teaching drums at a music store when I was 16. So I was working the whole time.
Wow. And did you sense that at that point of your career or your, career, did you sense that it was going to be a living, or did you think this is just something I'm doing while I'm in high school?
No, I knew I could do this. I knew. I had a friend I played with when I was 14. It's a blues guitar player named Jesse Ed Davis. It was kind of, people know him from Taj Mahal. He did all the slide guitar work, but he moved out here when I was 16. He tried to get me to go with him, and he was working immediately with, you know, he did the concert for Bangladesh, and he was playing with Rod Stewart, and he said, oh, you got to get out here to LA, you know, and come with me, because I knew I could make a living playing.
So but then, at that time, you were thinking drums only, right? You wasn't thinking the list.
Never thought about anything to being a producer. That was Andre Crouch that did that for me.
So we're going to pivot to Andre. So you meet Andre. How did you meet Andre? What year was that, and how did you meet him?
I met Andre because it kind of at the end of my rope of playing in a band. The band was falling apart. I moved to Nashville. I was 21 years old, I think, at the time. And I was at the end of my rope, and I prayed, you know, God, if you give me peace, you'll help me. I'll do whatever you want. And I sensed he told me to go back to Oklahoma. And I joined a band there called Barefoot Jerry. And that day they decided, well, we don't know if we want to do this anymore. So if you want to go back to Oklahoma. So I left and went back to Oklahoma and went to a mission called The Open Door, where Hadley Hockensmith, who had been in our band, was playing guitar. And I went to church there, gave my heart to Jesus at that time, and was very serious about it. We then prayed for Harlan Rogers and led him to the Lord. He'd been a keyboard player. And then Fletch Wiley, who was a trumpet player in our band, we prayed with him, and we all decided to just go to this little church, start playing music. It was a little, really a mission, like six, seven nights a week. Like a revival. And Andre heard about us. Kenneth Copeland told him about us. And he was passing through, and we went to his concert, and he came down and heard us, and he said, you guys got to be my band. He started working, and finally in July of 1972, he called and said, I'm going to be on the Tonight Show, and I'd really like it if you come out and play with me, because I'm not sure, I think my band needs a little help. So he flew me and Hadley out, and we did that. And that was my first time playing with Andre. And then we became his backup band shortly after that.
Wow. It literally happened like that, steps.
Yeah.
Wow.
Over a period of time. But yeah, that's a short version of it.
So did you, had you ever heard of Andre before that?
I never heard of Andre until I became a Christian.
Okay.
And then I heard the Keep On Singing album, and I liked the way the vocals sounded.
Right. So
how I didn't love the music. But I didn't love the music, you know, because the music still sounded a little bubblegummy to me. And it didn't have the funk that I felt it should, but I liked the vocals.
And I was just getting ready to say, so 1972, if I remember correctly, I wasn't born yet, but in 1972, Just Andre came out. And that was that the first record you produced with him?
Or I didn't produce it. I didn't produce it. I played on it with him. Bill Cole produced that.
Bill Cole, okay.
Yeah, I played on it, but I learned a lot.
And so by the time you did Take Me Back, which was the first one that you did, right?
It is, but I learned where I really learned and kind of cut my teeth in learning producing was on Live at Carnegie Hall. Mm. Andre had recorded that before we joined him,
right,
in March of 1972.
Okay.
He didn't like the record. And he told the record company, I'm not going to put it out unless I can redo things. And they didn't think he could do it on his own. So they wouldn't give him the master. They made a copy of the master. And then we started out by, I replaced the drums, which was extremely difficult to do because if he sped up, I had to speed up. If he slowed down, I had to speed, slow down. But fortunately, it was recorded with a piano pickup as opposed to microphones. So there was no leakage of drums in the piano, which is where that would usually be. And there was no, there was leakage of drums in the background vocals mics, but they had monitors. And so we replaced the background vocals so that those old drums wouldn't show up. And that Andre and I stayed in that studio for about 3 weeks, redoing drums, bass, guitar, organ. We redid everything except him. It was him and the audience. Andre's piano, Andre's vocal were untouched. And we had a great engineer named Eddie Bracken who had a tremendous amount of experience. And he taught me about things like making loops for crowds to fill them in. He taught me how to balance things and tricks he was doing to get rid of it. And that was where producing started to make sense to me. And it had to be handled at first on a technical side for me to get it, understand what a bus was, what each channel did, what the equalizers did, how you could, move things around. So Eddie was responsible for teaching me in the beginning.
Wow. So because one of the things I noticed about that record was when you guys had the audience clap or when they were, hooray or whatever, it was mixed in a way that it sounded like it was really happening as opposed to spliced and put in positions, which is
we wanted it to feel like exactly what it felt like if you were there and sitting right in the audience. And to do that, when you're replacing things that the audience was hearing, you have to listen to what the original crowd did and throw in that at those places so you feel like you're in the audience.
Wow. Yeah, I noticed it. When I even as a kid, I remember hearing it and going, this sounds like this was, like I couldn't comprehend how, as a 7 or 8 year old, how they could create something that made it sound like you were really there.
That's what we tried to do. And a lot of people would tell me, yes, I was at that concert, I saw you. I wasn't there. I played Carnegie Hall years later with Andre several times, but not that time. Right. But as long as they gave them that's what they felt like, then we accomplished it. And that opened the door for Andre. That record came out, and I think that everyone was surprised how big it was. And then Andre could go to the company and say, I don't want to have a staff producers producing my record. I want to produce myself. So initially it was a deal for Andre to produce himself. And he asked me, you've got a lot of musician friends out here, people I'd met in Oklahoma and Texas. So the first band that I put together for Take Me Back was mostly people I knew from back there. Dean Parks, David Hungate, the bass player.
Mm-hmm. Alex Kuhlman was on that one too, right?
I'm sorry, what?
Was Alex on that one too? They played percussions?
No, Alex came later.
Okay.
I didn't meet Alex until the late 70s.
Okay.
But I don't remember who I used on percussion on that. I really had trouble finding percussions that was easy for me to work with until Alex. And then I started finding all these great people, Lenny Castro and I can't think of everybody, but there were so many percussionists later that I got to work with. Luis Conte.
So Take Me Back, that record. Okay, let's talk about that record, because that was your first really initial produced record from my study. Yes. Is that correct?
That and the Danny Bell record right about the same time. It was even introducing Danny Bell. I don't know. It was, I did those two.
So you did three Danny Bell. You did He Is King, the Christmas record. You did. Yeah,
the one before. I did one before that.
Okay.
And then I did four Danny Bells. And then I did Let Me Have a Dream.
My favorite. Oh my God.
Ooh, I did this Jesus. Moment. I did this moment. Introducing Danny Bell, I think was. So I was doing those at the same time.
So you were producing Take Me Back and these other records pretty much all in the same couple years, yes, or whatever. How were you able to do that? Because Take Me Back, first of all, Take Me Back is a masterpiece. Like, I was listening to it the other day and I'm just sitting there going, Bill Maxwell is either not human or either he just had a sense of God connection that was able to create a masterpiece. That record is a masterpiece. Like, okay, what was you thinking when you were putting up? And you can literally, reason why I give you credit is because, and Andre, I've talked to Andre before he passed and he gave you credit all the time. But one of the things that I noticed was it completely changed Andre's vibe, his energy, from Take Me Back on when you came in into play. So what was you thinking? How did you craft something that was so classic?
Well, you don't go about it like that. You just, I had one advantage that most other producers didn't have, and that was that I was on the road with Andre, and I could see what was working. I could see what worked with audiences. I could see what was me meant something to someone. And he wrote the song to Take Me Back while we were on the road. And he had been performing it in front of audiences and it got better. And we could see what worked and how it didn't. And it was ready to go, that song. Some of the other ones weren't, but I had that advantage of knowing. And then it was just the same process that I always have. I try to see what's pure Andre and try to make it as good as I could without messing it up. You know, right. You just, how do we cut this? Okay, we decided to cut it with a band. Andre didn't want to play piano on it because he felt very uncomfortable playing with a band live. So Joe Sample played piano, but we cut it live with Billy Preston on organ.
I said Billy Preston on organ, right?
Joe Sample on piano, another Texan, Wilton Felder on bass.
Yep.
Dean Parks on guitar. David T. Walker on guitar, and me. And that's how we just cut the basic track. And then I had Andre replace Joe to play like Andre, because no one played like Andre.
Right.
And I just felt that, you know, he gave me trouble. No, Joe's great. And Joe is great. Nobody liked Joe Sample, but what Andre did, that's what that song was. It was him. And then we started doing vocals, which is where it really came in. Andre would say, "Oh, we got to do background vocals this week." And I say, "Well, great. Let me know how it turns out." And he said, "No, aren't you coming?" I said, "No, you're producing this record." And he said, "No, you've done more than me. I just showed up." Wow. You know, I would try to get good arrangers for him and different people. Fletch was in the band. He arranged the rhythm tracks for a lot of that album, Fletch Wiley. And then we got Larry Mahoberak, who was a great arranger who had been in Texas. It was the guy who put Elvis's band together and worked with Barbara Streisand string arrangements. And we got Larry and had found a kindred spirit that really could get into. I loved Andre, loved his voicings, and he arranged some things. And then it was just like the process. You do the vocals. I learned kind of backwards, but I didn't know. You do the vocals, and then you put the strings and horns on or whatever the. And you should always have your vocals done first, because then it matches. Right. You put the strings and horns on, and then you do vocals. Maybe some of the counterlines or things should come up. So the more important things you needed to have in place. I just accidentally walked into that, but I learned it.
Wow.
And then you just try to do every song as good as you can. And when we turned it into the record company, they were disappointed. They were disappointed because they said, you know, this record, it's not what Andre's been. We're afraid he's going to lose his audience. And it said, and the record is kind of all over the place, because we had a Dixieland song.
Right.
And we had a blues song called They Shall Be Fine. Then we had the gospel song and Take Me Back. And then we had a stylistics kind of song and All I Can Say.
And then the rock song, He's Coming Back for Me.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like he said he would.
Just like he said he would, right.
Yeah. And that was kind of a rock and roll. We had all kinds of, and they said that, you know, this record is all over the place. We had praises with a Hawaiian guitar. And, you know, it was for formatted radio today, it would never work. Right. You know, it didn't fit in any of the segregationist radio that we have in Christian music now, which is absurd. It wouldn't have fit those formats. But Andre was, you know, he was always stronger than me. When they were beating me up, you know, he said, I don't care what they think. I like it.
Right.
I think it's the best record I ever did, and I like it. And that was, okay, then if you liked it, it is you. I wasn't trying to produce me. I was trying to do what he did as good as I could, to, you know, to help him. And that's, and we, it took off. You know, people liked it. They enjoyed it. And so Andre's feeling was, I can do any kind of music I want as long as the words are scriptural. And so whenever they would say, why are you playing this blues? Why would you have that? And Andre would say, listen to the message. So he would always have an answer for them because he backed it up. And his dad always told him, if it's not scriptural, you don't put it on there. You don't record it. You have to stay in that. So that was why people endorsed Andre, because at the bottom line, what he was saying was correct.
Right.
But musically, most of these people wouldn't have wanted that in their home. Because right. They were produced of traditional music. So in that way, we broke down the barriers you're talking about, because we were allowed in your home. And I've had, you know, Rafael Sadiq.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rafael's a friend of mine. I love him very much.
Great.
And he told me the same thing you just said, that in his house, he couldn't listen to anything. And he didn't like anything. And he gravitated to the Winans and Andre and the Hawkins family. And that was what, you know, so I hear this a lot. But did I have any idea that was going to happen, that I would think it'd be an influence on young African-American musicians in the church? No, but I'm thankful for it.
You know, let me tell you something, Mr. Maxwell. What you don't understand is, to us, not just gospel, but pop, R&B, all of us that were kids who are now adults, we were all worshiping Bill Maxwell. And I use the word worship in a very, you know, appreciative way. But we worship your music, because what we realized, if we were at least listening, was that you were taking us somewhere where we had never been. You were influencing our thoughts and our brains and our ideas. I'm in film, but I totally put a lot of what you put in that music in my work. And so I've talked to many people who know you that are very, very famous. And they're like, what you did, and just not just Andre, but just what you've done has been just such a blessing to them. I want to talk about This Is the Day record. So you coming off
This Is Another Day?
This Is Another Day, I'm sorry. Yeah. So when you coming off of Take Me Back, and now the record company is starting to see, maybe this will work, did you have any pushback with This Is Another Day? Because that was a little bit more pushing, and you pushed it a little bit further with This Is Another Day.
I had fun then, because it will even us along.
Right, okay.
I enjoyed making that record a lot.
Right.
I had freedom, and we had on this one, we didn't have on the other ones. We had the freedom. If we didn't like something, we could do it over. So Take Me Back budget was really tight. If I didn't like a guitar part, I pretty much had to either cover it up or, you know, cover it up with Andre and a keyboard. I couldn't bring in a guitar player to replace a part. There wasn't money for that, those kind of fixes.
Right.
And this time I had a little more money,
right.
Money for a better string section. So the first one I got to really had to do the lowest price guys in town off the books. And I didn't want to do that. So we had more money and we had a little more time to experiment. And we continued the same thing, you know, which we have This Is Another Day, which was like an R&B, Natalie Cole gospel type song. And then you'd have Soon and Very Soon, which is very traditional gospel. And then you had You Gave to Me, which was like almost R&B, like could be funkadelic or something.
It was very funky, yeah.
And so there was a lot of variety again. But
We Expect You Anytime. We Expect You, remember that song?
Yeah, James Felix sang that. James
Felix killed that, the vocals. Oh my God. Those vocals, ridiculous.
Yeah, I've never heard anyone sing it this good. And that song was another example. It started with Andre's insecurities, which they continued. And as we had more money, he got more insecure and the budgets would go up. But he decided we've been doing We Expect You Live in concert and went over. We knew it went over. But Andre said, I'm not the right person to play it. I'm not the right person to do it. I think it needs a band. And I think the way the chords are, I think Clark Gassman can arrange this and we do it with a band. And he brought in a big elaborate arrangement, but it just wasn't intimate. We did it with the band. It didn't work. And Andre said, I was wrong. Larry Mahobrack is the arranger. And he can do it. I said, Larry's a great arranger, but I think it should be you, Andre. You know, just you playing piano and we'll come in and support you in areas because you sound like an orchestra. No, Larry Mahobrack. So we'd spend the money on another section, bring in a full band. It's better than the first one, but it's not right. And then Andre says, okay, you're right. It should be piano, but Joe Sample, not me. So we bring in Joe Sample. And Andre plays it for Joe, and Joe says, Andre, you should be playing this. I don't play like this. I mean, this is you. No, Joe, you have that tear in your chords. You've got that little thing that needs. Joe played incredibly, but it wasn't the song.
Wow.
It wasn't the song. So finally, I said, Andre, would you just go play this thing? One take. He plays it. One take. Overdub drums. In the middle part, and James Felix put on a little bit of bass, and that's it. And then there's the vocals. But I had to go through all that money to get to that. And that started the trend that continued all the way with him driving me nuts, trying to do anything to keep him from singing the song or playing on the song, because he did not like anything he did. He thought everybody was better than him.
Wow.
And that was the struggle. And he's a genius and one of my favorite singers, but he'd always say, no, Perry Morgan would sing this better than me. Howard Smith is the voice you got to have. No, we need to do that pilot. Danny Bell sing it. It was always a fight to get him to sing.
Wow. He talked, when I talked to him about, we were talking about doing this movie, he literally looked at me and said, it's Bill Maxwell that made me me to the next level. No, he did. He told me. And I even asked him, why do you say Bill Maxwell? And he said, because he had an ear and a sound that he created a sound and he had an ear that I needed, you know? And so he gave you high praise, at least to me. I don't know what he said to other people.
No, he's always been, you know, he's great. Andre, Well, I praise him too. You never hear me say a bad word about him
musically, right,
or personally. I love him. It's still loving, but he's the one that recognized something. And I said, how did you know this? He said, because I could tell you can't stand anything that's not right. You want to get everything right,
right,
as good as you can. And I like that.
Yeah. You know? So let's go to I'll Be Thinking of You. I want to talk about that record. So now you guys on top of the world. You got budgets now. You got Stevie Wonder. You got Philip Bailey. You got all these people now wanting to work with you guys. Is this because of all the success that you guys were having and they saw that the sound y'all were creating, they couldn't create? Or was it just because you were now Bill Maxwell and people started to kind of go?
Oh, they didn't come because of me. No one came because of me. They came because of Andre's great talent. You know, if you really are serious, how could you not sit back and listen to Andre and say, this guy's really good?
Absolutely.
And it would be nice to work on that. Stevie Wonder was no difficulty. He just said, I'm a fan. Of course I'll play. You know, figuring the time to get him and showing up and all that was a different story, but you know, ended up getting him at about 2 a.m. at his studio. But he played his heart out. He played a great Stevie Wonder harmonica solo. And he gave Andre as good as he gave anybody else. And Philip Bailey wanted to do it. Philip was a big, big fan of Andre's music. It was easy. So it was a blessing, you know, actually, that they wanted to be a part of.
What was your concept for I'll Be Thinking of You? That's my favorite. So I'll give you my favorite Andre Crouch records. My favorite is I'll Be Thinking of You. My second favorite is Don't Give Up. We're going to talk about that next. Don't Give Up, because you guys only did one record with the Warner Brothers. And then my third favorite is Take Me Back. The only reason why I Take Me Back is number three for me is because when I'll Be Thinking of You came out, it was the first record that spoke to me as a kid. Take Me Back speaks to me now as an adult. So it's my number one. Get it? But as a kid, hearing those sonically, I'll Be Thinking of You and Don't Give Up was like, my brain was like, and just, I couldn't take it. So I'll Be Thinking of You, what was the concept and what was the thought behind it? It felt like an almost like a clubby nighttime. The pictures were sexy. Andre's got the beard, he's got the clothes. The music sounds like something you hear on like in Manhattan, some club, like it was, on what was it? What was your thought and the process in making I'll Be Thinking of You?
I just wanted to do a really good record. You know, Andre's songs were evolving. It wasn't just praise songs. It was he had more different things that he was discussing. Still, all very good. And we had a couple of big songs on there. Jesus Is Lord, just kind of permeated it within the, you know, within the Black church anyway.
It killed.
and took off. And I'll Be Thinking of You was, we knew it was a risk because it was more of an R&B song, but they hired an R&B publicist and he said, I can get this within top 25 or something R&B. And he did. So it kind of broke on the radio. So, and that way it was in more homes than just somebody's parents bringing it home from church. So it kind of established Andre in broader places, but it was no big intention. You know, I just wanted to do it. We had a little more money. Again, we'll do it right. We got great bands. You know, Abraham came in then, and Alex. We had started losing my voice. He's done two of these this week. Alex came in and started playing percussion, which helped a lot.
So. Let me ask you, so did you feel, what is your favorite Andre Crouch record? Before I go into Don't Give Up, I want to talk about that a little bit. What's your favorite record that you've produced for Andre that you just kind of go, I feel like I did my best with this one?
Well, I can't really listen to any of them, you know, very much. Yeah, I'll say, my goodness, why was my backbeat behind on the first bar? I couldn't get through one bar without playing it right. You know, say, why did I put that much echo on the, you know, I should have been better in my proportions.
Oh,
I'm still working.
Right.
I've never gotten to a place where I should have left the bass out for 8 bars. You know, I go through that process. Andre and I were different. He hated them while he was doing them, or not hated them. It was like, he didn't want to stop. Everything had to be replaced. I loved them while I was doing them. And then he loved them when they were finished and could play them all day long. And I never wanted to hear them again. So I don't know. I really don't know how to answer that. I would guess, I would say Don't Give Up is a flawed, great record.
Right.
Okay. Not flaws, but there's some great stuff in that.
Yeah. I think
there's things that were ahead of Michael Jackson, before Michael Jackson cut, that now is to do that a lot with David Williams, who was Michael's guitar player that I love playing with, and he played with me a lot. And we took advantage of his great talent. So that game, but there was, you know, I had Lewis Johnson from the Brothers Johnson and Abraham. I had great bass players to play with. and the grooves were more intense.
Yeah.
Handwriting was more, that was more my alley of R&B. And that, you know, that was, you know, more intense. As far, do I think the songwriting was better? No, maybe not. Some of them. But then I, you know, it was one song called I'll Be Good to You, Baby, which I liked, but it, you know, it's a very misunderstood song. In fact, Andre's talking about talking to a girl, I'll be good to you, baby. But it's actually a song about the babies that have been aborted and are in heaven in God's name. Right. And that song, you know, caused a lot of offense with people. And at Andre's funeral, I ran into, you know, the brain is just a terrible thing to waste. Guitar player, producer, bass player, friend of mine from Nashville that wrote the big Eric Clapton hit, If We Could Change the World. Anyway, he was back there with his guitar and he said, listen to this. And he played I'll Be Good to You just with his voice and guitar. And it was incredible. And I said, well, I blew this song. He really understood what that song was. Wow. So we should redo this. And it was so powerful. But there's things underneath it that I maybe overproduced or didn't dig out enough. I mean, you'll see, I'm always working on this. This is, you know, it's my passion. Try to make the music better, try to see if it, you know, does more.
So Don't Give Up, that had a lot of people on it. Joe Sample was on it, Phil Keaggy, Tata Vega starts to really start to see her really come through. What experience, it seemed like Don't Give Up was a different experience than all the other records. Am I wrong on that or am I right?
Well, Warner Brothers, you know, their kind of thing was, Andre, we know you believe your message. Now, what record would you do if your message is going out into the clubs and you were trying to talk to the people on the streets? And that kind of was just thinking when he was talking about Hollywood Scene.
Hollywood Scene.
We're recording most of that at a studio on Santa Monica and Vine called Paramount Recording Studios, not Paramount Pictures, but all out in front of the streets, you see hookers, male right. hookers, guys and young kids out there all night. And Andre would come out and see that. And he said, you know, just arriving in Hollywood, saying, looking for a good time. And just, you know, he was like, what can I tell you? You know, how can I reach them? He had a very passionate message about that. The church didn't like it. But I, at that point, I didn't care. I mean, it was a sincere amount of love shown for people that don't know God. And that's what Andre was trying to do. But it was like, oh no, he's gone Hollywood now.
Yeah, right. That record, I'm trying to figure out who owns it because I want to do a movie with that as the soundtrack, a musical with that record. Because it's such a visual record.
Well, I think Warner Brothers still owns it.
They still? Do you know who I need to talk to? We talk off air because I'm trying to find out who owns it. So I want to use that record. And I've talked to Donald Lawrence about it.
There's all these music clearance firms
right.
that you could call. It's up there. It's up there somewhere and there's a rate for it.
Okay. Yeah, because I want to make that a movie. That's a movie. That record was put together so well. And I was really blown away with when I listened to Don't Give Up is how you were able to speak the language that Warner Brothers would have wanted. You know what I mean? Like, you got it. It's just that the church were, I think, I don't remember when I was a kid, but it seems like the church probably was like, what is this? Because
that was like what they said, Aretha left the church. That was when Andre left the church.
You know? Right. Because right after that record, you guys went gospel with finally. You guys just said, okay, do gospel.
Well, no, because it was a conscious effort then that we were going to do more progressive things for Warner Brothers. And then we kept the deal with Light Records. It's just Warner Brothers never wanted to do another record because it didn't recoup its money.
Right. So you guys were going to do more Warner Brothers records?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. How many were you guys going to do?
I don't remember what the deal was, but they had an option and they didn't pick it up.
Okay, gotcha. So you guys were kind of, Andre had a dual, I guess, label.
Yeah, he wanted to do worship songs and things like, and we were, the record finally was we were working on right after that.
Right. And it seemed like Finally was like the record you guys just said, okay, let's just give the people what they want.
No, we didn't. Well, no, we didn't think that. Like I said, we had two agendas.
Okay.
We were doing a Warner Brothers, more of a pop record, more that would appeal to younger audiences, R&B.
Right.
Then we're going to do kind of what Andre had always done. It's same within more of the gospel line, but it wasn't like, oh no, this didn't work, and we'll try this.
Okay.
I never ever thought of that way. If a minute you think like that, you're behind.
Right.
If you got trying to do what people want, you've already lost it.
Right.
You got to be the leader.
So let me ask you this, getting off of Andre for a second, I want to pivot to your producing credits. So you've done so many records that were CCM considered contemporary Christian, from Second Chapter of Acts. I brought up Barry McGuire earlier, the Cosmic Cowboy record. You was like working with Sparrow Records. I think there was a record company called Star Song, I remember one time that you did something for, and Maranatha Music. There was a record company called, I think, Lamb and Lion Records. Like you did, it's almost like you was doing all these different artist records. Did you have like a production company at this point because of Andre's success, or was it just you were out there hustling?
I did everything by myself.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I love to work, and I didn't turn down work. I enjoyed it. And so I just worked every day. I worked almost, 12 hours a day every day. And then when I go on tour with Andre, I'd fly back and work on things. I kept working for years. That's all I did.
So the Winans, the first record, you did three records with the Winans from my studies. You did Introducing the Winans, you did Long Time Coming, and you did Tomorrow, the record Tomorrow, the full record. Those records are classic records. I'm going to go on record and say, I think most people that are Winans fans will say those three records are their favorite Winans records. Although Decisions was great, Let My People Go, amazing work, Anita Baker, all the stuff that they did. But that's kind of like, for me, those records were kind of like what you guys were going to do with Andre at Warner Brothers. They're more made for a different crowd. But those three records were classic, just classic stuff. Talk about the process of those three records for you in terms of how you approach production. Scott B. Smith helped you on Tomorrow. But the first two records pretty much seemed like it was just you and Marvin. Talk about the process.
We heard them, the Wine, as they were called, the Testimonial Singers in Detroit. Through Andre had a singer from Detroit who moved out to Los Angeles and was a fan of Andre's, and Andre met him, Howard Smith. And Howard started singing with Andre and doing some background sessions. Howard's an incredibly great singer. And he had been a member of that group, the Testimonial Singers. And he said, you gotta hear my old group. And so we went to Detroit, and they came to our concert at the Ford Auditorium. And I think they came on the bus afterwards and played us a tape. And we went, what? I mean, Marvin's was 21 years old, and he sounded like Rance Allen or something. You know, he was big, big voice with character. And these guys were good. So we went back and said, you guys want a record deal? Yeah, so Andre used his clout. He'd set a production deal with Light Records, Crouch Productions, for me and him to produce them. And they came out, and we had no money because they really, Light Records had never done really a predominantly Black artist that was their art. They sold to primarily to the African-American community. Walter Hawkins was the first on Love Alive that they had done, but they really hadn't, maybe Jesse Dixon, but this was unique. And they didn't give us much money. And what I did was I was no genius in this, by the way, because he gave me a tape of their songs, and I went through it, and Andre went through it, and we picked the 10 best songs, And one of the songs we didn't pick was The Question Is, which is the biggest song off the record.
The biggest song on the record.
Yeah, so it shows you I didn't know what I was doing, neither did Andre. But they sang it live at something before we recorded and wrecked the house, and we knew, okay, that has to go on here. Because they had so many. But my problem with that record now, when I listen to it, is because we had so little time, the background vocals could have been better in tune. So the songs are great. So a few things I think, you know, Marvin would repeat his verses. I should have made him write a second verse. You know, I'm always catching things that I could have made better. But that one, it was a really quick recording. So all I did was put a band together, a very basic band with piano, bass, drums, guitar, and put them in a booth, and we followed them. I mean, we had arrangements written up of their songs, and we followed them, and we just played to them. And I maybe had the money to do one horn overdub session, one guitar overdub session, one synth section, and some background vocals, and that was it. It was like, put it out. And so in order to do that, I got the best guys I could, which was basically my band, Koinonia, with Abraham, Alex Acuna, and then David Williams and Hadley on guitars. Arlen Rogers and Tom Keene, who wrote out a lot of the charts. So that's what we did. And we did the first album. It did pretty well. And then they wanted a better deal, so they left Cross Production. So I did the second album without Andre, which I really liked that album, but they couldn't sell it. It didn't take off. And so the third record was the one that, we had, I think, one more shot with Light Records in order for them to try to make it up tomorrow. So I didn't have a big budget, and I brought Scott Smith in. I said, Andre gave me a credit and helped me get started, so I'm going to do the same thing for you. If you'll carry some of this load, do the horn arrangements. And I'm still going to be producing it, but I'm going to give you this credit. And he did a great job.
He did an amazing job.
And so that album took off. And then they got a manager who said, you don't need to be here with these, there's this label who doesn't appreciate Black folks. And, you know, it could have been right. I don't know. Right. So they left. And with that, the manager wanted me out, which hurt because I loved them so much. And I wanted to stay with them, but Marvin and I still are best friends.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But I wanted to stay with him because I kept thinking, I'm going to bring this one home. You know, these guys, I can just see how good it can be, musically, spiritually, personally. They were from a very poor family, 10 kids, all living in the same little house. And, their world changed. And it's all because of their God-given talent. Not because of me.
Right. So how did you get to PTL to do BB and CeCe's first record, Lord Lift Us Up? That record had some really nice songs on there. And did they want you because you had worked on the Winans, or that was just something separate?
BB and CeCe wanted me. And then I had played on something, I think, for Tammy one time, and they wanted me to produce Tammy, and I didn't do that, but they knew me.
Why didn't you want to do Tammy's record? Because she did a lot of records.
I just wasn't my style. Mm-hmm. You know, okay. There's only one reason you can think of to do that, and that's maybe money. That I don't do things based on that.
Right.
I was the right guy for her kind of gospel. I mean, she needed someone that was what they did, and it would seem like it'd be a contrast. It wouldn't work as well. So BB wanted me because I'd been with his brothers, and CC did, and they did, but they had an executive there who I didn't really like. And at the record company, he was one of those guys that was trying to tell you what to do, and he didn't really know what to do, and he puts his name in big letters above everybody. I was just one of those guys that it was not about the music. Right. And so they didn't have much of a budget, and they put the world's worst album cover, worst thing I've ever seen. So I said, these are not the people to work with. I felt stupid for doing it, but I want my love, BB and CeCe. Right. You know, you have to.
That like, album cover.
Hard to quit saying yes to so many things.
Right.
There was some red flags there that I didn't, you know, catch.
Keith Green, that's a very unique connection between you and Keith Green in terms of production. But you guys did a lot of work together. What was the synergy between you and Keith Green that made that work for you?
Well, I just liked him, you know. I liked his music. When I first met him, he caught me. The record company said, "You got an artist interested in you producing for Sparrow. Want you to co-produce it with him. He's not going to give total authority to anybody because he has very strong opinions about his own music." And I said, "Well, I should at least hear him and meet him." And so I went over. He's a really nice guy, and he played me some of his demos, and he sounded really good. But he didn't sound like anything special. He just sounded good, you know. And it sounded kind of like mediocre pop songs, but maybe could get some airplay, but not really hits. It didn't floor me. And I said, "Well, what else you got you working on?" And he sat down and started playing piano and singing. And it was like a whole nother person. It was like an animal came out. He was like, you know, a white Jerry Lee Lewis. Just wild when he's playing and conviction with his words. I said, "Why don't you sound like that on those demos?" And he said, "Because I sing different when I'm playing piano." And I said, "Well, then you should sing when you're playing piano. Don't stand up." And that's what we did. I just took him in, and you know, you baffled down the piano, put mics on it, you put a big piece of plastic in front of it and a microphone through the plastic so that he could isolate his voice, and he played and sang live. And I cut all his records with him playing and singing live because that's the way he sounded the best.
Wow, that's crazy.
And so it was fun finding that, and then he got it, and we just kept digging together. We go in and dig in and see what we could come up with. And it was fun. He was a very disciplined writer, a different kind of personality than Andre. He wrote out, when he wrote a song, he wrote out all his lyrics, he wrote out all the chords, he had a lead sheet. It was all, you know, he was prepared. He did the song the same way every time, pretty much. So it was executable. So I played a different kind of drums because it wasn't spontaneous. And we would always cut with just piano, bass, and drums because I didn't want a chordal instrument to get in the way of what he might come up with piano. So I would later overdub the guitars to fit with what he played. But, you know, this is the things of producing. You just try to find. I didn't try to make the Bill Maxwell record. I don't know what that is. Tried to find what these people did and try to do that as good as I could to present them in the best light I could. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't.
So why didn't it not work, you feel, with Bruce Hibbert? Because that he only did one record.
I didn't produce Bruce, I just played drums.
Oh, you didn't produce?
Mm-mm. But I remember it was a good record. I think Jonathan David Brown produced that, but I'm not sure. Jonathan was a good producer.
Okay. Did you produce Scott Wesley Brown?
Yes.
Okay. So what was different about Scott Wesley Brown in terms of in production? I've seen him do interviews, old stuff, but what was it like with working with him in production? He seemed like he was one a lot like Keith Green too, but was he not?
I don't remember as well. I know that I didn't spend a lot of time on that record. It wasn't a big budget.
Right.
I think he was living back in Ohio or Pennsylvania or something. I remember flying back there and doing vocals in Pennsylvania at some studio. But I don't remember as well. It's a long time ago.
Second Chapter of Acts. What about Second Chapter of Acts?
Oh, they're fun. I had fun playing with them. You know, those are such
Matthew great Ward.
Great singer.
Amazing.
The three family harmonies are fantastic. Michael Amardian, arranger, producer, was arranging that. It was great to work with Michael. I mean, I enjoyed it.
I have so many questions. I got to try to narrow this down. Okay, let's cut to your TV and movie stuff. So how did you start getting into TV and movies? You did The Martin Show. You've done, everybody know Jamie Foxx. But how did you get into doing score, a music score?
Again, through essentially through Andre and a manager that I had. The first one I did, and it's not a well-known show. I saw some version of it that was very poorly mixed. I know the show wasn't like that. It was a rough cut, but it was a tribute to gospel music on Showtime that Glenn Campbell was the host of, and they had Andre and Ray Charles and Denise Williams and the Hawkins family and a few people. And I got the job as music director for that. And that was my first getting into TV. And I love learning stuff. And so they had all these machines that you could sync together. Now it's all easy, but in those days with tape machines, getting them to sync together with the film and all the things you had to do, it was like a new world of technology. And so I did that special and thought, well, this is kind of fun. What was fun about it is you worked really hard for a week or two and then it went away. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't like you're spending a year on this thing and you just burned out. I thought, this is kind of fun. You work really hard and then you don't have to listen to it again. You know, it keeps you moving.
Right.
But I didn't have anything. And then Andre asked me to help him write some music on The Color Purple. And so we met with Quincy Jones and we worked on some of the gospel music for The Color Purple. And through that, Reuben Cannon was the casting director of The Color Purple. And Reuben was hired by Ed Weinberger to be a producer on his new series, Amen, with Sherman Hensley. And they suggested Andre for the theme song. So Andre wrote a theme song, and Andre asked me, he said, I don't know anything about how to fix this to time or how to do that. Would you help me cut the track so it goes out to be exactly a minute or hour long it was supposed to be, to come produce this theme song for me? So I didn't like sitcoms. I didn't know who Ed Weinberger was, that he was the producer of Mary Tyler Moore's Show and the creator of Taxi and I didn't care. I just didn't like sitcoms. Right. But I went in and, you know, they had Vanessa Bell Armstrong set to sing it. And I did the session fast, efficient, you know, it was good. Got it done. And Ed Weinberger is a very demanding person. And we finished it, and this one producer saw me working with him. She said, you can work with this man. Nobody else can. I can tell you can work with him. He listens to you. He doesn't listen to us. And so they said, would you do the rest of the music without Andre for the pilot? And I said, sure. And then they gave me an offer, and I said, no, I can't do it for that. And they said, why? And I said, because he's going to be a pain in the neck and I'm going to spend a couple of weeks on this. And it's like, you know, you're not even paying basic, the most cheap drum price. So eventually they paid me to do it. And I got through the pilot and it sold. And then they didn't hire us back. They didn't call me, they didn't call Andre. The show was coming on. And then I get a call back from someone. Can you come meet with Ed Weinberger? They'd hired, H.P. Barnum to do it. H.P. Barnum was Lou Rawls' arranger. And I guess, you know, they didn't like the cues or something that he'd done. It wasn't, didn't fit the show as much as it didn't sound like the theme song. So they made a deal for me and Andre to come back. And so I came back and they got rid of all the music that he had done and we redid the music. And just, I would cut it with me and Andre and a bass player and sometimes a guitar. But the problem I was having was, in order to write the music with Andre, I'd have to get with him. Well, getting with him means getting him up in the morning and getting him to the piano and recording it and then getting it to a copyist to try to arrange it and get it to where it got. And it got later and later. We're getting, missing deadlines and it was just painful. And then Andre would get there, and because he's a free spirit and he can't read, he'd forget what he came up with. So the sessions were running long. I was having problems, and it wasn't Andre's fault. That just wasn't his expertise. It's in his area, and he wasn't that into it. So at the end of the first season, I ran into Ed Weinberger, and he said, are you coming back next year? On Amen, I said, I don't think so. It's too much work. And he said, well, why? And I said, I'm not getting paid enough for this amount of work. It's just not. I didn't realize in television is just basically about money. You know, people, that's why you do it. And I kind of needed a break from producing Christian records because I felt I missed the Winans. I missed that, my joy had gone out of that producing and getting little return for it. So they offered me a good job, and from there it just took off. Then I met, you know, Martin's people called, and Jamie Foxx, and they just kept growing from one show to the next. The word was I love Black folks, and I would work hard and do the best I could, you know. So I started doing a lot of Black situation comedies. And that's basically how it happened. I didn't have an agent. They just would keep calling. At one point I had, I think, 6 shows on the air at the same time. I was running like crazy.
Yeah, I saw your name all the time. And I was like, man, he's working harder than
I just kept working. I went through a very painful divorce. And I just tried to fill my time with working every minute.
Okay. You know? Yeah, that's hard. So did you work with Helen Baylor because you just wanted to? Because during that time, you was kind of doing other stuff at that point.
Yeah, I wasn't producing any Christian artists.
So why did you choose Helen? Why did you choose to work with Helen?
The only Christian artist I was working with was Phil Driscoll.
Phil Driscoll?
Right. I liked what Phil, and he was good, and I did a record for him with Word that they liked very much, and Word had Helen on their record label.
Okay.
And they'd had a split with her producer, and they said, we'd like to pair you guys together and see what you think. And I just liked her voice. As a matter of fact, I don't think I've told this. The reason I got the Martin show was I had a really close friend, Paul Jackson, I still have, who was doing the music for Martin. And Martin had a falling out with his creator of his show, his manager, and they split ways, and he didn't want anyone that guy brought in working on the show anymore. And he brought in Paul and another guy to do the music. So I was on a session with Paul for Helen Baylor. I just started doing her album, and I got a call that, would you be interested in doing the Martin show? And I said, what about, well, it was actually Paul Jackson and Greg Perret, a guitar player. And I said, what about Paul Jackson and Greg Perret? And he said, I think they're out. And so I went in the room and I said, Paul, what's going on with the Martin show? And he said, we don't know. Why do you ask? I said, because I got a call to ask if I was interested in doing it, but I'm not going to do it if that's your job. You'll try to keep your job.
Right.
I stayed out of it. And then Paul called me a couple of days later and said, no, we're out. And Paul appreciated that because we're still good friends. I wouldn't try to take his job.
Right.
And, so they said, well, Martin wants to hear something. What do you have? And so I listened to the different music I'd done for TV, and I thought, he's not going to like 7-second music or 10-second music. I'll just send you some of these Helen Baylor tracks. So I just send this is what I'm producing right now. I sent over some instrumental without the vocal of the Helen Baylor tracks. So the other people he had in there was the guy who'd done the music for Seinfeld. And so Martin hears like a little boom, stops. He's like, why the music stop? And then Quincy Jones the third or fourth or whatever, brought something in, the same thing, little short cues. And he puts on mine, it's a 5-minute groove. And he goes, well, this is what I like. Of course, that you couldn't use 5-minute groove on the, but at least he got a sense of what I did.
Right.
And so that's how Martin, you know, I met Martin and he said, I love your tape. You know, that's good. Can you do that kind of music for me? I said, sure. And then it just kind of evolved. And then from there, Martin's producer went to work for, created the Jamie Foxx show, and they called me on that one. And then I, from Martin, I went to work with Yvette Lee Bowser doing some Living Single and her next show, For Your Love. I just kind of all worked, kind of ran into each other. I put about 20 years in of that.
Did you think when you were in Oklahoma City that any of this would happen?
I thought I was going to be playing with the best musicians in the world.
Okay.
I knew that.
Okay.
I didn't know if anyone would pay to hear it. I didn't know what it would be. It would be sitting in some, you know, little club in New York City. But I knew that I could do that. I knew, because I had friends, I started playing so young. I had friends like Eddie Davis that said, oh, you know, you come out here, there's a place for you. And, you know, I really trust God with all of this. I mean, this is not me. But I had a boyhood friend, T-Bone Burnett. I met in Texas, when just out of high school, and T-Bone had a recording studio, and he co-produced our band, and we've stayed friends. And it seemed like when the sitcom thing died down and music production, you know, was not as much, then T-Bone started calling me to do movies with him, with the Coen brothers, and then
Tom Hanks movie, right?
And then from that, you know, I met Elton John and went to work with Elton and Leon Russell, who's my friend from Oklahoma. And T-Bones got me involved in so many fun things like the movie Walk the Line and, you know, different film projects, record projects from artists all over the world. So I just, you know, T-Bone is the one who got me the job as a music director at the White House for Barack Obama's gospel concert. And so T-Bone's always been there. You know, it's God and his people being nice, you know, getting me involved. I met Ryan Tedder through T-Bone, who has a group, One Republic, another Okie. And he's a producer producing John Legend. And he brought me in on his album, something for One Republic. And then they brought me in on one song on John Legend's album and an album for an English singer named Jesse J. Incredible singer.
Yeah, sweet. Incredible singer.
Incredible singer, great, great, sweet girl. And I brought the best singers I could in and we had a ball. So I kind of have that going now as I arrange and put together backing vocals for movies and TV and records.
Wow. That's amazing. Wow. So we almost took, time is almost up because I know you
have. Well, I can give you a few extra if you need it. You got something.
Okay, I appreciate it, sir. I just have about maybe 4 or 5 questions. I want to pivot back to the Daryl Coley live record. That probably is Daryl Coley. I want to represent Daryl because he's deceased and he's someone that I'd like to continue to remember because he did some great, great stuff. But that record, the live record, was just an incredible, incredible record. But one other thing I noticed was it didn't sound like anything you ever done. So you really do have a gift of being able to captivate or find what the artist is looking for.
That's what I try to do.
Creating that. Because Daryl, that record doesn't sound like anything else you've done. So what was your process on that?
Does it sound like anything else he's done?
No.
Okay, good.
No.
So that meant
that's why I chose that record. Because
I don't know. I just heard the songs. And I can't remember where we recorded, but I know it was a very live place. It may have been Santa Monica or something.
Yeah, I think it was in L.A. Definitely was L.A. Yeah.
It was a live. It was like maybe in Santa Monica Auditorium, but it was a very live kind of brittle sounding room. And I remember fiddling with having to place the room mics in different places to where I could get it to where it, with the room mics on, where you can feel the audience, that it sounded, that technically it was a little hard. I just remember rehearsing the band with Daryl and going through the songs, and Daryl pretty much, he wanted his music a certain way. He wouldn't let me jack with it that much, but I did a few things, tried to hone in on the grooves with the band and to see about the pacing of the concert and what it was. And then it was a lot, the sound of that room. I just remember that I really screwed around with the mics and even in mixing, trying to find a way to make it work. It wasn't working at first. But I think it was good. I don't know if it sold a lot of copies, but I think it was a good record.
It's a great record.
And I don't know that I've heard it since, really. I'm pretty bad about keeping these things.
Carnania. I want to hit on Carnania. So was that concept something you came with, or it was just all friends deciding we're going to tour and do some music together?
It started, I think, on the second Chapter of Acts album. I got the call from I think it was Michael Omardian to
great piano player, Michael, by the way.
Yeah, he's a great piano player.
He kills. If you ever want to hear a great theme, guys, a great piano solo is a record you produce. It's on the I'll Be Thinking of You record. And the song is called I'm Looking For You, I think it's called.
Yeah, that's my point.
He does an amazing piano thing in that record. So anyway.
Michael's incredible. Well, he called and told me that it was a second Chapter of Acts album, and it was going to be Jay Graydon, great guitarist who produced Al Jarreau and played guitar on Steely Dan's Peg, and he was a great guitar player. And Abraham Laboriel on bass, and him and me. And I'd never met Abraham Laboriel, but Ernie Watts, saxophone player, told me this great bass player is from Mexico is here, you can't believe. So I'm
always smiling.
Always smiling. Well, I went when I was excited to meet him. So I went in and Abraham took my hand and he started crying. And I said, he said, "This is another day changed my life." And I said, "What?"
Wow.
And it was so sweet. And then I heard him play, and I'd never heard anybody play like him. We just immediately liked playing together. So we had a session was like 10 to 1, and then an hour break, and then 2 to 5. And they were going to lunch, and he said, "You want to go to lunch?" And Abraham said, "You want to stay here and jam?" I said, "Yeah." So we just stayed at the studio, and he put on a 15 inches per second, 15 nips tape. It goes for 30 minutes. We played together for 30 minutes and then filled the tape, just improvised. And then he put on another roll and we did it for another 30 minutes. And Abraham said, "Let's start a band." I said, "Okay, when you want to do it?" He said, "I don't know, but I'll let you know." So this was about 1977, 76 or 77. In 1980, he called me and said, "I'm ready. Let's start a band. Who do you want in it?" And I said, "I like Alex and I like Dean Parks." Dean Parks was my friend from Texas and played on the early Andre records. And he said, "Well, I've got a great saxophone player, John Phillips." So great. And I said, "Maybe Harlan and Hadley would want to do it." And he said, "Sure, let's do that." So I called Harlan and Hadley and Dean, and then Abraham called Alex and John, and we set up and started rehearsing. Just wrote some songs, and we thought we'll just write our own songs and we'll get together and jam at the baked potato, play them and see how it goes. Hadley didn't come to the first rehearsal, and he came to the second rehearsal and he didn't like it. And I remember he said, "Max, I don't think I can play this music. It's too hard. And I don't think, even if I could, I don't think I'd like it. I don't even really like this music."
Wow.
I said, "Hadley, give it a try. Come on." You know, it's just, he ended up doing great and having a ball. And then Dean didn't want to travel. We didn't expect it to be anything. Abraham was like, "Oh, let's call it Koinonia." Okay. Koinonia, what does that mean? Communication, sharing equally. Oh, didn't know it was going to be a tongue twister name. And we didn't think anything. We just were going to go play at the baked potato on a Monday night. And line started going a block around. They couldn't keep them away. They were full. And then we went to Europe. It was the same thing. The people just kept lining up and they would come and we had nothing to do with it. It just, people came to hear us. And then it struck a chord with the people in Europe, and it gave us another form of, to me, ministry, going out and playing instrumental music for all people, not church crowds, but for playing jazz festivals and still being who we were. And that's been one of the great joys of my life, is to play with people that good, that every night you had, Alex would wear me out. He was a drummer with Weather Report, all kinds of technique. I had to come to my game. I didn't know about Latin music. And then Justo came in plus John Phillips. Those guys were, you know, from serious Mongo Santa Maria and Afro-Cuban music. But I had a lot to learn, and I love learning. I had to get more familiar with odd times, playing in 7, playing in 9, playing in 13, playing in 11, things I'd never done and feel comfortable. So it stretched me. And that's still what I love. I love learning.
Do you spend more time now just producing, or do you still play drums too now?
Well, I play drums, but there's not that many drum sessions.
Right.
What we've been trying to do is once a week, I still have a band. It's right. called Open Hands with Tim Carman. I don't know if you know Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Tim is one of the great keyboard players.
He's amazing.
I got him to replace Billy Preston when Billy was doing the show Good News and had to leave the show. Tim came in. And so Tim is in the band. Abraham is in the band. Justo's in the band. And then Abraham's son, Mateo, has been rehearsing with us, so I think he's going to play some. He's more of a rhythm guitar player. He's not as used to soloing, but he comes up with stuff. So we've been practicing once a week, and we're going to play at Herb Alpert's club, Vibrato, in March. So we're trying to ease back into it.
I'll be there. I want to see that show.
Okay, good.
I want to see that show. So I'm going to wrap it up. We have a thing called Top 5. And it's basically where I ask you your top 5 favorite things. And you just kind of tell me the top of your list, or top of your head, what your thoughts are. So I'm going to start with your top 5 favorite songs you listen to get any type of inspiration.
That's really a tough one. but there's a certain thing I like about classical music.
Mm.
It clears my head, and it puts me in a place outside of it. And I get so used to thinking in band terms, because I've always been in bands, to where keyboards are in this register and guitars in this register and that. But to hear the registers expanded with violins up very high and things down low and harmonies underneath, and it gets me stimulated. My ears are perking up with the chords and voicings and things, and it's interesting. But you know, there's certain things, like I did a documentary, or was asked to be interviewed on a documentary about Billy Preston this week. There's a song they said, well, is there particular songs of Billy's that you listen to for inspiration? I said, well, not any of the hits, you know, not that stuff. But there's a song he wrote, which I didn't even have the full version, that he sang at our wedding, called Music is the Voice of God. And when I put that on, it touches me, because I sense Billy's heart in it. And it is true that music is an international language understood by all mankind.
Yeah.
And music is the voice of God.
Mm.
So if it has a message, if it reaches me emotionally, musically, there's so many things that do that. And it can be different days where I grab it from. Sometimes it's an Andre song.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's a Marvin song. Or Donnie McClurkin. I listened to We Fall Down the other day. I said, oh, Donnie, you hit that one.
Yeah.
You know, something that's real. I like real music. I don't like planned, organized, preordained, everything's got to be this way, and I figured this out, and this is the hit, and we do that. Somewhere there, I miss the human soul. Mm-hmm. and the emotion. I like real stuff. I like real singers.
Mm-hmm.
I like an old singer no one's ever heard of called Lou Johnson. He was from New York, that Burt Bacharach produced before Dionne Warwick. Certain ways he sings words really touch me, you know. So I like people.
Mm.
When they put their heart into it. So yeah, that one's, can you try me another? I can't really be that specific.
Yeah, that's good. Okay. Top 5, I'm going to go light. Top 5 favorite foods.
Again, hard. I like extremely fresh, really good.
Anything. Okay.
You know, fresh ripened tomatoes and balsamic vinegar and Italian olive oils and roasted fish. But then I love gumbo. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And my wife made the best collard greens I've ever had for Christmas. And I love that, you know. So Black Eyed Peas. This, I guess my roots, you know, my grandmother made black eyed peas, grits.
Fish and grits, or shrimp and grits, or just grits?
I like grits anyway, and I like shrimp and grits, but then I'm not as, I don't eat as much shrimp as I used to. But yeah, I like just the flavor of grits, simple. Grits with gravy.
Like
smothered chicken.
Top five favorite things to do when you're not producing.
Well, I haven't been doing it lately. I love to go fishing in the ocean. Mm. Love to catch big fish. Love to ride horses. I feel at one when I'm with a horse. And I love to travel. I love taking my wife places that she was, this is our second marriage. We've been married 21 years. Congrats. And she hadn't traveled as much, at least outside of this country. And I love taking her to new places that she can. You know, she was telling me today, I'm getting birthday greetings from all over the world, from the people she's met. And it makes me happy to take her and show her some things.
That's beautiful.
And music was, it's been so great to I could get the privilege to travel to all these countries and meet so many different people. And so she's experienced that. So I like that.
That's beautiful. Top five favorite I don't want to ask something goofy, so I'm going to try to, because this is Bill Maxwell, so I don't want nobody to beat me up. Top five drummers, young or old, dead or alive, top five drummers that you think are just like impeccable.
I have to say I love Abraham Jr. He's like my son too. I love him as a person. He has a beauty in his playing. He has all kinds of technique, but he never uses his technique as an expense to the song. He always puts the music first, my rule. And a lot of drummers don't. They put the drums before they put the music. And so that if you do that, then that's not my kind of drummer. Of course, I love Alex Acuna because I think he is the greatest percussionist drummer doing both that I've ever heard. He can play drums and wear you out. Play percussion where you're at, and he's so spontaneous and free. It's like something comes in the air and it changes him, and he just can do anything. And he's a beautiful person who loves the Lord, spiritual. So Alex is an inspiration to me. Jim Keltner is a guy that has such a beauty in his touch and the way he plays drums. I don't know if you know him, but he's been around for a long time. He played drums with all the dual drums with Ringo. With the Beatles, and he's played with Steely Dan and did those records. Mm-hmm. And I've known Jim since before I moved to California, and he helped me so many ways. He got me my first drum endorsement, got me my second drum endorsement. he would always, we love playing double drums together. So Keltner is right up there. There was an old rock and roll drummer that died recently, and it's a friend of mine. And what he did, Ronnie was great, Ronnie Tutt, this drummer, but he played on a lot of records, a lot of different kinds of things. Of course, I love Bernard Purdy. Mm-hmm. Bernard had a great feel with his shuffle and the different Bernard things.
Bernard, beast.
Yeah,
beast.
And then Elvin Jones is at the top of my list, and the way he moved with the music. I liked Sonny Payne, who was his drummer that could twirl the sticks and do all these great fills. Steve Gadd's an incredible drummer. But I tend to, like people that put the music first. So, right, they make the music sound good. Another great drummer that people don't know about is named Paul Lyne, lives in Nashville now. Paul's a session drummer here, played on all the Lionel Richie hits. But he had the best sounding drums, and he was ready to go on the first take, could read anything, and the records always sounded great that he played on. Played on more hit records, and he's just an instinctive Dallas drummer. Now that I actually met him when I was 17 or 18 playing in clubs in Dallas. But and Ronnie Tutt was a Dallas drummer.
Wow. That's crazy. Top five albums that you listen to or that you like? Maybe you don't listen to them, but you like your top five albums.
I feel, you know, like with any every musician, kind of blew my Miles Davis.
Yes.
Throws me into a place that.
Yes. I listen to when I write.
Really?
Yeah, man. That's the one for
me.
I
was cooking the other day and I turned that on to cook to.
And yeah.
That record, I like John Coltrane Live at the Village Vanguard, the way Elvin Jones played a song called Chasing the Train. That one, I love Herbie Hancock's Maiden Voyage album.
Yeah, that's a good one.
You know, I truly like that. There's more, I'm not naming all the styles. I still have certain James Brown records, you know. On the one. Yeah, they, Mother Popcorn, there's a, you know, a bunch of those that I play Bobby Blueland Grooves. I love that drummer. Same one James had, Jabbo Starks, Turn On Your Love Lights, and Yield Not to Temptation. Bobby Blando's drum beats were impeccable. Difficult, but play was so relaxed. But then again, you know, I like rock and roll too. You know, there's been certain rock and roll records that'll really get me. And certain, and not all the Beatles stuff, but certain Beatles songs are fantastic.
Oh my God, absolutely.
That's, you know, incredible to listen to. As far as in Christian music for composition, Andre's music still gets to me. But when I hear him say, if heaven never was promised to me.
Nothing touches it.
Yeah, you know, that gets me as much as anything.
Yeah.
When I hear Donnie sing Stan live, you know, it gets me. So I don't know. There's so much music that I love. And like I have, when I was working with Elton John, I put together some background singers to go on the road with him, including Rose Stone, Sly's sister that was with him, and Gene Johnson, Witherspoon, the same with Andre, and Lisa Stone, and Tata Vega. And so they sent me rehearsal tapes for me to practice the singers with Elton before they went. And they sent me a tape that no one has. It's three songs of Elton. And one is a song called Take Me to the Pilot. And he plays an improvised piano introduction for about 4 minutes up in front of the song. I don't know if there's another copy of it anywhere. I've downloaded it on a hard drive in my car. I play that all the time because it's so inspirational. It's like he was anointed. It's an incredible piano player. I had no idea Elton John could play piano like that. And so certain moments when you see that inspiration of music taking over, that's what I love.
Elton John is an amazing piano player.
Yeah. It's just, they had a style like nobody else. And so, you know, and when I get it, I have that in my Infiniti car. I haven't sold it. It's got a lot of miles on it now, but it's the only place I have it. I can't get it off the hard drive. So I go out and drive that car to listen to that.
Wow. Who's your, how did you meet, I was going to ask you this. How did you meet your wife, your second wife?
I was playing at church in the way with Rose Stone Choir. Rose had a gospel choir at the church on the way. And so she was the music coordinator for the church. And she would call me and, you know, say, can you play drums with them this Sunday or that they needed. I kind of had a deal going. I didn't tell anybody, but it was like, if anybody asked me to play at church, I would always say yes, if I wouldn't do anything else, something I'd do for the Lord. And they started calling, I'd say yes, you know, when I could. And I met her there, didn't really think much about it. And I, you know who Pee Wee Hill is?
Mm-hmm.
Pee Wee's a bass player.
Mm-hmm.
His wife is Japanese, Michiko, and their daughter's Judith Hill. Well, Pee Wee was playing bass.
And she's an amazing singer, by the way, guys. By her new record, this came out like a couple of months ago.
Yeah, she's great. Pee Wee was playing bass for Rose's choir. And Pee Wee came up to me one day and he said, I have an anointing. He kind of stutters. He says, I have an anointing for hooking people up in marriage. So I put Ronnie together with his wife, Ronnie Van. I put Caleb Quay together with his wife. I put Chester. Yeah, he's naming all these people. He said, and I got the girl for you and she likes you. I said, what? And he said, you should listen because I have an anointing. I said, okay. Well, then he went to Yvonne and he said, I got the guy for you and he likes you. Said anything. She never said that. He just lied. So he's got an anointing for being a liar.
A liar, right?
But it sounds like a hyped Hollywood story, but one of my best friends that time was a pro basketball player and he was playing for the San Antonio Spurs, David Robinson. And they were playing the Lakers on Christmas Day. And I had season seats at that. That was when I was working a lot of TV. I had season seats for the Lakers. And so we talked and I said, okay, would you like to go to the Laker game? She said, yes. And I took her to the Laker game, but I wasn't sure about her. So I had David sell him standby after the game. We all going out. And so I'm sitting at the game with her. We're having a good time. And I ran into Jamie Foxx. And Jamie was, there was someone. He said, what you doing after the game? I said, oh, no, I've got David and I've got my friend Yvonne with me. We're going to go somewhere to eat. He said, come to my house. I'm having Christmas dinner catered. Come over. So we went to Jamie's after the game. And met his sister. He had a sister with Down syndrome. Sister was so sweet. And his family. And had a nice time. I dropped Yvonne off and then hung out with David a little bit. And that was kind of it. And we hooked up once more and went to another basketball game. And then I got busy working. I was working on some shows. And I was doing a show for Showtime called It's Black Entertainment. It was taking all my time trying to get us a movie to make. So I finally got that finished and she sent me a Valentine's Day card and said, just to think, a short time ago we were strangers and now we're just strange friends. And it cracked me up. So I called her. And then we started hanging out. And then I wasn't sure I was, worthy of being a husband. But I didn't know what was going on. I didn't feel like getting married. I just told a friend of mine, I'm never getting married again. And she started sending me little scriptural things. And they were exactly what I was praying about, exactly what I was reading. Mm-hmm. And I started sensing God in her. And when I recognized it, and it was the best decision. I remember about 4 or 5 months later, I called David Robinson and said, I'm going to get your advice. Should I ask her to marry me? He said, I don't think you can go wrong on this one ever. And that was great advice.
And 20 so, years later.
21 years later. It'll be 22.
And tonight is her birthday.
Tonight's her birthday.
So one final question. Are there any albums that you've mixed that you like did a full mix of the full record?
I'm not an engineer. I need someone to, I've had some that I've done them where they set them up and I ask, can you do this for me? And I'll run all the balance. But I that's not my best work. Mm. I did a lot of that with the Winans.
I read that you mixed one of the records.
But I had a good engineer, Bobby Cotton helped me, but once I got the money to have someone great like Bill Chenet, I don't want to touch a fader,
Right.
You know, if I could, I just sort of sit back and listen. You don't want to have to be wondering, is that limiter working? And I find that I do much better mixes if I leave and come back in and listen, because if I listen too long, the echo starts going away. I'll put two more echo and I'll turn the bass down because the bass will start irritating me after so many hours. So if I walk way and I'm out for an hour, 30 minutes to come back in, I said, wait, where's the bass? What's wrong with the echo? I mean, I'll hear them. So I, being under it like an engineer, I found I do better work. You're letting them get them going, then I leave and come back and make notes, and then I could kind of hone in on it.
Got it.
It's a process.
Have you had any producers that are known that have come to you and acknowledged the great work you've done in this industry, music and film industry?
Yeah, I have. It's very nice, very, very nice. I just say, I tried,
Have you ever met Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis?
Yeah, but I don't think they knew who I was.
Oh, they didn't know who you were. Mm-hmm. I think they know. Maybe they know the music. Well, it's been a pleasure, man.
At a basketball game.
Basketball. I mean, so if you was at the Lakers, I'm sure you met one of them.
Yeah. That was why I was with David in an All-Star game when I met Jimmy. He knew David, I think.
So I've got to get my pennies together because I want you to write. I want you to do a soundtrack and a score for one of my films. So I got to count my pennies together so I can
afford you. Okay, we'll do it.
We'll talk through it when we're off air. And I want to say, man, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, thank you. I had a good time. I had a little trepidation. I just don't find myself that interesting, to be truthful. But I'm glad I did it. I feel better.
You talk.
I knew I wanted to do it for you. I liked you. I said, I totally might do it. I know I have to do it. But it took me a minute to get myself ready. I'm glad I
really appreciate it. You don't know, man. I look up to you. I admire you. You're one of my, I hate to use the word idols, but you're one of the people I look up to. I wish I could have been a fly on the wall when I was a kid watching. But now I got you here, and while you're here, I'm gonna soak up anything I can, Bill Maxwell. So I appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, you know, love is the key. Really, love people. Love what you do. Be kind. Don't hurt people. Be honest. You know, there's so things. Oh, good things will come to you if you do that.
Yes, sir. You guys heard it last, Mr. Maxwell. Until next time, we'll see you. Be blessed.